The next matter is Gonzalez versus Nebraska Pediatric Practice. Again, the next matter is Gonzalez versus Nebraska Pediatric Practice. And you may approach.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors. This is the court. I'm Greg Garland. I represent the appellant. Welcome, Your Honor, to the bench. I don't think I should have been kicked out on summary judgment in this case. I think the trial judge abused his discretion when he struck my expert on the issue of causation, therefore sent me up for an automatic summary judgment. I had an expert witness who opined on all of the elements. He met all of the Schaefersman qualifications in his designation. He adopted the designation during his deposition. And he met all the predicate steps to be able to testify. But the defense said that he was not a pediatric neurologist, so therefore he couldn't opine on causation. So we're talking about a physician, my expert, who is a family practice trained emergency room physician who treats on the age of 25,000 patients a year, I believe, and 30% of his patients are 3 to 4 year peds patients. So he's used to looking at kids with mono and understanding that they can morph into meningitis. So he's fully qualified on how to treat the patients, and he does it regularly. And he has opinions on what would have happened, that he would have had a better outcome, not loss of chance, but he said he would have had a better outcome neurologically had the patient been put into the hospital.
Did your expert ever testify as the basis for his opinion that had the child been in the hospital when the seizure occurred? Because I think he says he can't say whether it would or would not have occurred, right? If he was in the hospital, he's not opining it would not have occurred.
Correct.
He's opining that had it occurred, the brain damage would have been less.
Right.
Did he ever testify as to the basis upon which he makes that determination?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Very simply. I mean, the options were to go. Now this is a child who was in the emergency room twice in 2 days. The first time they diagnosed him with mono, he comes back 2 days later, and they decide not to do a blood test. So when they don't do the blood test, they can't tell whether anything has changed from then and there. And what he's saying is that when they sent the patient home with his mother, where he seized on the bedroom or the den floor 3.5 hours later, that if they'd have admitted him, and he had a seizure in the children's specialty hospital with all of the machines, medicines, and doctors standing right there, that the seizure would have been much less. And with a non-prolonged seizure, the chances for brain damage go way down. So that was the basis. Did he offer any kind of literature or anything to support that? No. But the logic is very sound. Your options are two. You want to have your child have a seizure at home on the floor after having been in the emergency room, or do you want to have it in a children's hospital with everybody around? The outcome's got to be.
So, counsel, there were a couple different bases for striking your expert. One was on competency, and the other one was on the speculative nature of certain causation opinions, correct?
Yeah.
I'm going to focus on the latter here for a second. On the speculative nature of the causation opinions, it seems like there were two different branches of opinions here. There's a branch of opinions that relates to had he admitted him and given him IV fluids and antiviral medications and anti-fever medications, that may have resulted in a better outcome. Was the court correct in saying that's speculative? That may stuff or better chance stuff as it relates to that line of testimony, that speculative that should not have come in. The court was correct in that regard. Would you agree?
Yes, but in his designation, he states that to a high degree of medical certainty, it's opinion number 11 in exhibit number 2, that there would have been a better outcome for the patient had he been in the hospital. So
because of the seizure control, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so let's focus on that for a second. So again, bifurcating those as it relates to him being in the hospital and it relates to those medications and what he says may have, but I think his ultimate opinion here, as I read your brief, and that you're challenging is, had he been in the hospital, they could have better controlled the seizure, and it was the lack of control of that seizure that contributed to this young man's brain injury. Is that your position?
That's better than I can say, Your Honor. 100%. Yes, sir.
And with regard to Judge Reedman's question, then, did he go into any length and say why? Number one, how would you better control the seizure, and how does that contribute to the brain injury here?
Okay, well, so let's look at where it happened. Where the seizure happened was in the home. So by the time they called 911 and got the kid up to the University of Nebraska Medical Center, which is the final place to go, but not a children's specialty hospital, I believe that was about 20 minutes. So what his opinion was there was enough evidence in the emergency room to admit it. And had he been admitted, well, I don't know that you would have had doctors standing over him the entire time, but you certainly would have had nurses standing over him who could have pressed the button and got all the care right there at that time. So by administering proper medications, that would have reduced the swelling. They would have used the anti-seizure protocols in the hospital. And so what seizure he would have been much shorter. And with each second that goes by in a seizure, where someone's brain is swelling, that's going to equal big problems, which eventually happened a couple of days later with a craniotomy and a giant scar on his head, which it bothers the kid a whole lot, but at least he's alive. It would have obviated the need for that surgery had he been there. So that's all we have about the seizure.
Is that his opinion here? If he's in the hospital and they better control the seizure, you would not have needed the craniotomy?
Yes.
Craniotomy?
Yes, sir.
And that's why you have additional brain injury, because you wouldn't have needed the craniotomy.
Yes, sir. That's it. I think the exact words, what he says here in exhibit number two, is that with a high degree of medical certainty, he would have had a better neurological outcome if he had been admitted to the hospital immediately after he'd been seen instead of sent home. And in his list of damages, he says less likely brain damage, and that's on deposition page 117, line 13. I mean, this is a summary judgment motion, and I'm not trying to waste the trial court's time by bringing some expert in who doesn't know what he's talking about, but I have an expert who does know what he's talking about. And as this Judge Gleason said in his order, that it would have required a pediatric neurologist to opine on this. If that's where we're going, I just need to know we're moving into the world of specialty medicine and we're kind of abandoning the old concept that a medical doctor can testify in an area of specialization, even if he's a generalist.
Well, the judge is concerned with regard to the progression, right? So his ability to be able to testify as to causation on the progression of this particular. Do you agree with that? That was the nature of his order. In other words, I don't think he's saying that he couldn't testify with regard to the standard of care of admitting or not admitting. It's the issue of causation and whether or not he had sufficient knowledge to testify here as to whether or not.
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
the seizure might occur with that. I think I see where you're going. So what we're saying is what the defense was saying is emergency room doctor who treats patients exactly like that lacks ability to testify on causation. I don't know that that's right. I mean, the fact that using terms like he doesn't follow up with patients, well, follow up in medicine is a term of art. You know, it means coming back to visit you. It doesn't mean you don't know about things, and it doesn't mean you're ignorant of outcomes. And, you know, when I know there's...
I'm going to interrupt you because I got to address one more point.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
So as you relate, though, you also object that you objected to his expert witnesses.
Yes.
In connection with the affidavits he tried to put
yes.
in. And the judge kind of cut you off with respect to you make your Daubert Saperson objection.
Yes.
And then those were overruled. And you said they advocated dysfunction by not setting out the basis for that, correct?
Yes, sir. Well, in fairness to the trial court, he gave me an opportunity to be heard, and he let us say what we wanted to say. He just didn't rule what we thought was abuse of discretion to rule the way he did. And these affidavits that are coming in against us, well, they have no mention of methodology use or appropriate application, and we're using this affidavit as kind of a one-step.
Are you allowed to just simply at that hearing object? And at that point, the courts have to undergo a full Daubert analysis and present it in order to us, or do you have to bring some sort of a pretrial motion or challenge to those experts prior to that time?
Normally, yes, but when someone files a summary judgment motion before that deadline is there, now I'm stuck with the situation, okay, so he filed a motion to exclude, and I have to file a full Schaefer's motion to exclude theirs. I think it was premature. If you're telling us that anytime someone, you're going to raise any kind of Schaefer's objection, even though the Schaefer's time hasn't been, we're not there yet, to contest the validity or the admissibility of affidavits, and I just need to know about that because my steps in the future will be to merely just say, anytime we get one of those deficient affidavits, I'm going to have to now file my 104 motion to exclude, which accelerates that on the timeline for me. So, and on the summary judgment issue, well, you know, that wouldn't have happened if I had an expert on causation, so there's not really much to argue about this. The stuff we've been talking about is the crucial point.
Mr. Garland, before you sit down, the appellee in his brief states that your expert indicated in his deposition that he would defer to your neurologists and pediatric infectious doctors about the progression of EBV encephalitis, the treatment for it, and any seizure a patient may have had as a result of EBV encephalitis infection. Do you agree
that
your expert deferred to them on those issues?
He said that, but is deference the same thing as saying I'm ignorant? You know, because if someone comes to me, and a general lawyer comes to me and says, hey, I want to talk to you about a medical malpractice case, and I have a medical malpractice opinion about it, is he not able to come into court and say, I disagree with Garland just because I have general knowledge of medical malpractice or tort law? I don't think so. So just because someone would defer to someone in a room doesn't mean that they're saying they're ignorant of the topic themselves.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
Right, thank you
for your time.
Thank you. How much did we take Mr. Garland over? Can you add that to that, please, sir?
Morning. May it please the court. My name is Bill Settles. I represent the appellees in this case. I wanted to start first with addressing a couple of issues that were raised by your questions to Mr. Garland. One of the things that Mr. Garland said was that when the patient is admitted to the hospital, and I wrote down what he said, the chances for brain damage goes way down because you can control the seizure. Well, that's kind of our point. The opinion that their expert is giving is that the chances for direct brain damage goes down. That's a lot.
But he testified to the degree of reasonable certainty that in his opinion, the lack of control of that seizure contributed to this brain injury, does he not?
He said that at one point in his deposition. At other points, he couched it in terms of may and could have and may have. And a court that's evaluating an expert's opinion for reliability needs to view that opinion in its totality. Mr. Garland made reference to the expert's designation, which, of course, is a document drafted by Mr. Garland. And what's critical and crucial in evaluating the testimony is what does the expert actually say when he's asked the question? What are his opinions? He did say at one point in his deposition that if the patient had been hospitalized, that the seizure could have been less because of the administration of anti-seizure medications, and that that would have led to less brain injury. Our contention is that's the precise point that he lacks the qualification to give an opinion on, and that is the causes of brain injury, the progression of brain injury, what the effect of a prolonged seizure has. Mr. Garland suggested that a prolonged seizure causes brain swelling. The evidence that we presented is that it doesn't, that what causes brain swelling...
But that would be a question of fact at that point, correct? Unless Dr. Lawrence is not competent to testify.
Right? That's right.
Okay,
that's
so right. In that regard, is Dr. Lawrence, an ER physician, competent to testify with regard to a seizure, controlling the seizure, and how it can lead to brain injury?
I think, Your Honor, with respect to the first point, first of all, there wasn't ever any evidence presented that Dr. Lawrence possessed specialized knowledge in the area of brain injury and the causes of brain injury, the prevention of brain injury, the treatment of brain injury. We're not suggesting that a physician has to be a pediatric neurologist in order to testify about causation in a pediatric neurology case. But what Daubert tells us and Shaverman tells us is they have to present the court with evidence that they have specialized knowledge, regardless of what their specialty is, that they have specialized knowledge on the issue and on the question at issue. There was no evidence of that in this case. And when the court engages in its analysis, it has to look at a variety of factors. The Daubert factors are one source of things that the court needs to look at. But what we presented was also evidence that Dr. Lawrence testified that he would defer to a pediatric neurologist on these questions, that his opinions are contrary to what qualified experts testified to in their affidavits. That is that there's no evidence in this case that a prolonged seizure contributed to the injury. And it's also contrary to the medical literature that was presented, that providing these treatments that he advocates would somehow have arrested the progression of this disease or interfered.
Does deferring to your experts make him incompetent?
Not in and of itself, but it is a factor that I think the court can consider. Another factor that the court can consider is his uncertainty about the degree to which a seizure contributed. The Texas Supreme Court decided that in Couch versus Simmons, which is a case that's cited in our brief, where they said that one of the factors to be looked at in this, when deciding whether this testimony is reliable, is the fact that in that case, the expert, again, was talking about two causes concurring to cause an injury,
but he couldn't say how much the negligently caused cause contributed. And the court, the Texas Court of Appeals, said that that was a factor to be considered. With respect to the admission of our expert affidavits, the appellant has made the argument that the court abdicated its Daubert function and its duty to give specific reasons why it found as it did under the Daubert analysis, the reasons. And the answer to that is simply that the Daubert, the gatekeeping requirement was never invoked. First of all, these affidavits were offered in the context of a Daubert motion itself. They're not offered, they weren't being offered in evidence to go to the jury. I mean, the central thesis and purpose of Daubert is to protect the jury from hearing unreliable scientific evidence. There isn't any authority for the proposition that a court has to engage in a Daubert analysis of the evidence that's being offered at the time of a Daubert hearing.
But you want them to consider what those experts have to say in discrediting his expert, correct?
That's right. I mean,
so he can't challenge your experts saying they're not competent to tell you that my expert's not competent? You can't make that challenge?
Well, he has to evaluate the evidence. I mean, that's really what he's doing, is evaluating the evidence that both sides are presenting regarding the reliability of the challenged opinion. Now, if he were to find that for some reason the opinions in the affidavits were themselves unreliable, then certainly he would discount that as a factor in determining whether or not Dr. Lawrence's opinion was unreliable.
But there is that point set out in an order, so the appellate court can look at it and see the basis upon which he did or did not grant
the fee. But, Your Honor, I don't think that there is that Daubert obligation, that gatekeeping obligation that Daubert imposes to make specific findings in the order with regard to the admissibility of the evidence that's being offered at hearing, as opposed to the opinions that are being challenged under Daubert. And number two, the Supreme Court just decided that Hensley versus Langdon case about 2 weeks ago, and they made it pretty clear in that case that simply objecting is not enough. You have to present some sort of challenge to the basis for the opinion. You have to call into question the validity of the opinion before that Daubert duty, the gatekeeping function, gets triggered.
What the Hensley said, you can't just make a general objection. You have to be specific with regard to your objections.
Well, it said that you have to sufficiently call into question the basis of the challenge opinion before the gatekeeping duty is triggered.
Can you do that simply by saying, I object on
Shaverson? No. There has to be some argument or evidence for why the opinion is unreliable.
Did the trial judge give Mr. Berlin an opportunity at a hearing?
I don't recall, Your Honor, but as I recall the transcript, having read it, no, he didn't want to hear anything on that issue. He was a little abrupt. But again, what we're talking about is another factor that the court is considering in engaging in this Daubert analysis with regard to Dr. Lawrence's opinion. Whether or not those affidavits are high on the list of things that you consider or low on the list or should have been, those are discretionary issues. The question is whether the judge abused his discretion in evaluating Dr. Lawrence's opinion. And the appellants offered no evidence at all that Dr. Lawrence had any kind of specialized knowledge in the areas that he was being challenged with, which is the neurological opinions about causes of brain injury, whether a prolonged seizure causes worsening, whether in this case, you know, there's two levels of causation in medical malpractice cases, the general causation of can this condition cause this problem, and the specific causation of did it cause it in this case. And on both of those issues, there was no evidence at all that Dr. Lawrence had any foundation in those opinions. And you also have to look in the context of in the evaluation of Dr. Lawrence's opinions, as I said, you have to view them in their totality, which I think the court did. The court said in its order that it was after the review of Dr. Lawrence's deposition that it reached its conclusion that he was not qualified, didn't have the required specialized knowledge. It didn't say that he had to be a pediatric neurologist. What it said is that he's not qualified by virtue of training, expertise, or experience to render any opinions on the progress or causation of this child's conditions. Such opinions would require expertise and qualification in the specialty of neurology and specifically child. And that's what we're saying. We're not saying you have to be a child neurologist. We're saying you have to have specialized knowledge in the area.
The affidavits from the doctors that you put in, they talk about how EDD, when it progresses to encephalopathy or meningitis, can result in brain injury. And they think that that's what happened here. Do they ever, though, suggest that Dr. Lawrence can't be right, that a protracted seizure like this could contribute to a brain injury? Do they ever suggest that? They just say that we think it was the former, not the latter. Isn't that what they're saying?
Well, what Dr. Pathway said in his affidavit is that there was no evidence in this case that a prolonged seizure contributed to this injury.
What would that look like?
Well, you have to ask a pediatrician.
But they looked at that, presumably the depositions in terms of what does that look like, and that battle that would take place with respect to that point.
Well, they were not deposed. So those opinions were not explored in that way. But what they were saying in those affidavits is that, you know, prolonged seizure, I mean, the question is brain swelling. And there's no evidence that the prolonged seizure or the hypoxia from that, or that this child was hypoxic for a prolonged enough period of time to cause brain swelling. That might be one way that you could determine that. But again, again, it requires that specialized knowledge of how does a prolonged seizure cause brain swelling and brain injury? How does the EBV virus cause brain swelling? In order to tease out those specific causes, and the doctors who have the knowledge that there was no evidence that there was any contribution from the seizure. So again, another factor in the daughter.
Thank you. Very
thank
much.
You.
We're out of time, so thank you both very much. The matter is submitted. You are excused. Thank you. And Judge Reedman.